Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Jody. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Carol Moffitt, president of the Center for International Environmental Law, outlining the many problems with carbon capture technology. Then Mark Emancion, director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation, speaks about the week of PROACT Action. Later on, we'll hear from Sam Fine and Joe Ritchie, who both spoke at this past Tonko Tuesday rally. After that, Diane Film talks organizing her free community breakfast in downtown Troy. Finally, we'll hear from HMM regular Hugh Johnson about the finer details of determining weather patterns. But here, first are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that three of the companies blamed for the PFOA pollution of public and private water supplies in the Hoosick Falls have agreed to pay $65.25 million to settle a federal lawsuit with thousands of property owners and residents, including those who were found to have elevated levels of PFOA in their bloodstream. The preliminary settlement must be approved by a federal judge. The lawsuit accused Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics and Honeywell International, and later 3M and DuPont Co., of each having roles in the decades-long pollution of community water supplies. The settlement would allocate $23 million to fund 10 years of medical monitoring.
Governor Cuomo faces severe repercussions over a tweet in which his spokesman suggested a sexual harassment probe by the state attorney general of his boss was politically motivated. The head of the assembly's impeachment investigation warned on Wednesday. The assembly member on March 15th had warned Cuomo about intimidating or retaliating against anyone involved in the probe. Cuomo's press person linked a possible gubernatorial run by Attorney General Tish James to an announcement by the Transit Workers Union said they were no longer financially backing Cuomo.
The NY Post reports that Governor Cuomo ranked nearly 230,000 in campaign cash from donors tied to a medical network that got $62 million worth of emergency state contracts amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
As part of New York's initiative against gun violence, $950,000 will go to Albany for job training and workforce development, $700,000 to Troy, and $300,000 to Schenectady. The program is aimed at unemployment and or underemployed people between 18 and 24 years old.
Federal officials renewed their ban on non-essential travel into the U.S. by land for another month, deviating from Canada's decision to allow vaccinated Americans over their border as of August 9th. Canadian residents are only allowed to fly into the U.S.
In an effort to continue increased public participation at its meetings, the Albany County legislature is asking New York State to consider a possible amendment to the open meetings law to allow for remote participation via the web. They are proposing that committee meetings be held remotely to make it easier for both legislators and residents to participate.
The Troy Waterfront Farmers Market will be staying at its William D. Chamberlain Riverfront Park location for the foreseeable future. Many customers say they appreciate the open space and safety while the pandemic continues. The market does expect to move back to local streets at some point, as requested by local businesses. That's it for the headlines. Now, more than 500 groups recently called on U.S. and Canadian political leaders to reject carbon capture and storage as a full solution to the climate crisis. Carol Moffitt, president of the Center for International Environmental Law, outlines the many problems with carbon capture technology, which is largely designed to allow for the continued burning of fossil fuels. This segment is brought to us by Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're joined by Carol Moffitt, who is the president of the Center for International Environmental Law. And they were the lead group among 500 who recently put out a letter and a newspaper ad calling on the United States and Canada to reject carbon capture and storage as a false solution to climate crisis. So Carol, maybe you just start off with a brief overview. What is the Center of International Environmental Law, and what prompted your group to put out this letter and report on carbon capture and storage?
Thanks. The Center for International Environmental Law, or CL, is a nonprofit organization that uses the power of law to protect the environment, promote human rights, and ensure a just and sustainable society. We've been around for more than 30 years.
And so what are some of the problems with, you know, carbon capture? And I know, unfortunately, that this is something that many politicians have been very heavily promoting. And, you know, the deal that was cut on energy at the end of last year in Congress included a lot of money for carbon capture and storage. And it seems to be something that the mainstream Democrats are heavily promoting.
Yeah. And, you know, the problems with carbon capture and storage are many, but they can be distilled into a few simple facts. Carbon capture and storage doesn't work. It is incredibly expensive. It doesn't actually remove carbon from the atmosphere, and it's dangerous. And that last point is really widely disregarded in the discussions of carbon capture and storage. And it's notable that it poses particular risks for the same environmental justice communities that have been targeted for dirty industries for decades.
Can you maybe explain a little bit, what do they mean by, you know, carbon, you know, capture and storage?
The idea behind carbon capture and storage is that rather than address climate change with solutions that work, like expanding renewable energy and accelerating electric vehicles, that we will address climate change by continuing to burn oil, gas, and coal, the fossil fuels that drive the climate crisis, and that we will that industries will simply capture the carbon that is emitted, capture the CO2 that's emitted at the end of those at the end of those pipes. Capture the carbon coming out of the smokestacks at these facilities, separate it from all the other waste gases, condense it under massive pressures, and then pipe it tens to hundreds to up to 1,000 or more miles to be injected into the ground in the argument that it can be permanently stored. And the problems with this are many. The first and most fundamental problem is it is so massively energy intensive to run this equipment that the coal industry doesn't want to do it. It's not actually economically feasible to do it with gas. It requires you to burn more coal or oil or gas to get the same energy, which means you get more of all the other pollutants that come with those sources. And then once you pressurize that CO2 and put it in a pipeline, it becomes a very hazardous substance. And those, you know, it's being proposed to build 25,000 to 65,000 miles of these pipelines and run them through communities across the United States with a heavy focus on communities in southern Louisiana and the Gulf Coast of Texas. But really, you see pipeline proposals for numerous other places from the Midwest to California's Central Valley and beyond. And these pipelines are potentially profoundly dangerous. One of the other really fundamental things to recognize about carbon capture and storage is that because the process is so expensive, the only and there's very little demand for CO2, there's very little market for it. Most carbon capture and storage proposals are supported by injecting the CO2 into the ground just to produce more oil. 80% of captured CO2 is used just to produce more oil, which will then be burned to release more carbon into the atmosphere.
Now, some, people make the point that, you know, right now, you know, I'm very active with 350.org. The goal is to keep the, you know, amount of greenhouse carbon emissions in the atmosphere below 350 parts, I believe, per million. And we're, you know, well above 400, 415, 420. And they say, even if we stop burning fossil fuels, we have to, remove the existing carbon to get us back to 350. You know, so how does one respond to that? And is there a difference, say, between, you know, carbon removal versus carbon capture and storage?
That's a really fundamental point. And because these terms are often used interchangeably and they're not. Carbon capture and storage by itself does nothing to remove carbon from the atmosphere. even in the best of circumstances, it would only, you know, be carbon neutral. And that, in fact, never happens. It always ends up releasing carbon to the atmosphere. Direct air capture and other forms of purported carbon dioxide removal say that they're going to remove carbon from the atmosphere, but most of them, including direct air capture, actually rely on CCS to work. And I think the direct air capture is a case in point in this. With direct air capture, it is massively energy intensive because you're pulling carbon not out of a smoke stream, out of a waste stream, but out of the general atmosphere where there is, you know, it's one molecule out of every 10 million is carbon dioxide. And so you have to move massive quantities of air to capture that carbon. It's profoundly energy intensive, which means most direct air capture projects are actually powered by fossil fuels, with a very few exceptions. And most of the carbon being captured in existing or proposed direct air capture program projects is being used either to produce more oil, again, to be burned, or simply to produce diesel fuel and jet fuel that themselves will be burned. And so that's not carbon negative either.
So what should, you know, Congress and the world be doing at this point, you know, rather than investing in carbon capture and storage?
We have less than 10 years now to cut global emissions in half and only a few decades to eliminate them entirely. But the truth is, we know how to do that. We have technologies that work, and those technologies are already dramatically cheaper than using energy with carbon capture and storage. In fact, those technologies are cheaper than just continuing to build or use existing coal and gas-fired power plants. So the solution for Congress and others is to take those billions of dollars that they want to sink into supporting a dying fossil fuel industry and invest them instead in renewable energies, in building sustainable communities, in building more energy efficient cities. Those are the solutions that are going to create jobs, they're going to create opportunities, and actually going to create a livable planet on the time frame that we need to do it.
We have a little bit over a minute left. So two-part question, you know, are there some natural ways to sequester carbon that, you know, should be looked at? And if people want to, you know, support this particular call or find out more information about carbon capture and storage, you know, what's your website? Where's a copy of the letter?
Absolutely. So first, there are natural solutions. Protecting existing forests, helping restore degraded forests, restoring degraded agricultural lands, protecting seabeds and coastal mangroves, all of these things can capture carbon. Their capacity is not huge, but it's not insignificant either. And so they can be an important part of the solution. If you want to find out more, you can visit our website at www.cl.org. Carbon capture.
Well, thank you very much. You've been talking with Carol Muffett, President and CEO of the Center of International Environmental Law. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Thanks to Mark Dunley for bringing us that story. The interview with the President of the Center for International Environmental Law, Carol Muffett. Visit www.cl.org for more information, ways to get involved, or to donate to the cause of maintaining a healthy planet.
Now, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Protecting Right to Organize, PRO, Act last year, but the Senate blocked it. The House passed the PRO Act for the second time on March 9, 2021, sending the bill to the U.S. Senate. This week, the AFL-CIO engages in a nationwide PRO Act week of action, focusing on in-person rallies in U.S. Senator state offices. In this labor segment, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry interviews Mark Emanaten, director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation, CDALF, about the week of action.
This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk magazine. I have on the phone Mark Emanaten to talk about the PRO Act action that the AFL-CIO is doing. And Mark going to give us some information about what's going on with this. Okay, Mark.
Yes.
Yeah. So just tell on what is the PRO Act?
So the PRO Act stands for Protecting the Right to Organize. And what it is an act that's been passed by the House of Representatives. And we have now 49 U.S. senators that are supporting the bill, sponsoring or supporting the bill in the United States Senate. And we have a president that will pass that. And the bill is the first important labor legislation to make it easier for workers to join and form a union. That's happened in years and years and years. We have really restrictive labor laws that make it very hard to have a union, to organize one and to get a contract. And it allows the companies right now to basically do whatever they want to workers that are trying to organize a union. So this is a bill that takes away lots of those restrictions and makes it much easier for workers to form a union. We believe in the FL-CIO that there's probably 6 million or so workers that would join the union right away. And you can see what happened down in Bessemer, Alabama, in the organizing drive that the workers down there just went through to try to get a union in Amazon. And all of the roadblocks the company, threw up, firing workers, doing meetings and other things that forced workers into listening to company propaganda, all sorts of other things that really made it very difficult to form a union there. And so this PRO Act will make that, will change those things around and put us in a much better position to build the labor movement.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, the PRO Act didn't just start, right? I mean, it started on the Trump administration, right?
We were trying to get it passed.
Yes, right, under the Trump administration.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yep, you're absolutely right. We were trying to, and actually, unions have been working on this for a really long time to get this legislation through. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time that we have, and if you remember the President of the United States, Joe Biden's State of the Union message, he said, that he wanted to get the PRO Act on his desk and sign it, and was and that was, no other president has said that. Like I said, we have right now 49 senators. You need 51. You could get away with 50, but you need 51, really. And then you need a really big push by the American people to say, that they want that. Unions are more favorable today in the public's eye than have been in decades. We feel that this is the time to do this. The AFL-CIO, especially in the states where we're still trying to move senators, like, for instance, in Arizona, we're still trying to shore up the support of those senators down there. In Virginia, where Warner is, and in Alaska, where Murkowski is, we're trying to really push to make sure that they come to the table and support this bill. So that's what we're out and about trying to do.
Mm-hmm. So, Mark, you saying that you do have some Republican senators that are on board with this?
So right now we have no Republican senators on board with this. Not a single Republican senator is on board. The only one that we think the AFL-CIO nationally feels that it can get is the person from Alaska who's spoken favorably about this in the past. And they think that they could still move that person in Alaska. I have no knowledge of this, obviously, myself. But that's what the AFL-CIO nationally feels, that they could still get that person to do it. All of the Democratic senators are on board, with the exception of Warner. Mm-hmm. In Virginia. Mm-hmm. And the AFL-CIO down in Virginia has been working really hard to try to get him, and they feel they're making progress in that too. The more clamor, though, Willie, around the country, the more workers around the country all over say, we want this PRO Act passed, and we're going to remember who voted for it, who didn't vote for it, and you know, who blocked it and didn't block it, that'll have an effect, I believe, on some of this, on the outcome of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know recently there's a call for action around the PRO Act. It was from the 17th of July, I think, until the 25th. So what are some of the activities that y'all have been doing around the call for action?
Well, so we had a little bit earlier than this, we had Senator Gillibrand came to the Labor Temple in Albany, and we put on a big rally with the speakers and her, you know, supporting and calling for the passage of the PRO Act and explaining what this will do. As you know, and maybe some of your listeners know, the Capital District Area Labor Federation is in a coalition that we helped build that's feeding working people across the Capital Region. And last year, we fed 127,000 people. This year, by the end of June, we were over 160,000 people. Mm-hmm. And the lines are not getting smaller. They're actually getting longer, and we're running out of food everywhere we go. Last week, we did two, one in Schenectady and one in Albany. And we ran out of food within an hour and a half of opening the doors for people. So the getting out of poverty, if you could join a union and get a living wage and a decent wage, people would be able to rise out of poverty much easier than they can right now. And passing the PRO Act, having workers be able to get into unions and fight for their rights and higher wages and better benefits and stuff like that, that would go a long way to getting people out of poverty and stopping these food things. So we did that with Senator Gillibrand. She's done six of them with labor around the state, and they just did one the other day. She did one in New York City with the AFL-CIO down there, with Senator Schumer, and with Mario Salento, the president of New York State's AFL-CIO. So we've done that, but we've also spent as much time as we could talking about this on the news. We were on the news several times. We've raised it at every chance that we've had to speak, like, for instance, at the nurses, when the nurses won their contract. We spoke about that night, the battle that they had to win their contract would have been, and to get a union would have been much shorter mm-hmm. than the years and years they worked on it had we had this. And now they're going to go out and about and talk to people about this. The PRO Act, as they go out and spread the news that they got this contract and spread what I like to say, the gospel of unionism amongst the people. And you know, we're moving along on this. We're going to have in the next coming weeks a couple other events, a call-in thing. We're going to do a night of call-in and sending some postcards out. And then we're building towards a big, big Labor Day event.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be the celebration of unionism, but also the PRO Act will be a big centerpiece of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be at Cook Park, and we invite everybody and their cousin to come to that.
Right.
And we're looking to that be the biggest one we've had in years.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, I do have another question around the process, because Joe Biden, you know, since he's been in and he's been trying to get things passed, but the Republicans have just been stonewalling him. And it's take like 60 votes to try to get something really passed, unless you do it through what they call a reconciliation or something like that.
Reconciliation.
And reconciliation, right. So now, is the unions willing to push Joe Biden to take that route if they can't get this done through the regular process?
Well, that's a good question. And as you know, I'm the director of the Capital District Area Labor Federation, mm-hmm. and I have some responsibility for the unions around here. Mm-hmm. I don't really know everything, the ins and outs of how the AFL-CIO is approaching this in every state in the country. But I know that on the weekly calls, another one which is going to be today, that they have folks that are directors of ALFs from around the country on. They're doing a huge effort to get this done, to build pressure in all the states of the country and in Puerto Rico and in Canada. All of our affiliates, even people helping out in countries where in Canada where they don't, you know, they have a much better way of organizing unions than we do down here. The affiliates up there helping. They're pushing this on a level that I have not seen in a really long time with the AFL-CIO. We've also noticed, Willie, that, you know, we're in more labor battles as the hiring sort of upticks a little bit. Mm-hmm. They're trying to push the people that own the factories and the mills and the distribution centers and the Walmarts and Amazons and all that. They're trying to work us to death. And they're not hiring people to, you know, take these jobs. And there's a rising combativity amongst workers. We've got some strikes. You know, there's the miners' strike down in Alabama and Arkansas. You've got the Frito-Lay workers that are striking. You've got the Volvo workers that are striking. We've got some strikes happening around the country that show some real combativity. And I know that we're not the only ones looking at this, that the bosses are looking at this too. Mm-hmm. They're looking at it and saying, you know, there will be a point when the sleeping giant of labor wakes up and says, we're tired of doing all of the work while they fly to the moon.
That was Mark Emanation speaking with roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry about this week's Nationwide Week of Action to support the passing of the PRO Act. Dates and locations of in-person events around the country are available at the www.cdalf.org.
For those just tuning in, I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Jody. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
In this week's update of Tonko Tuesday, our very own Lucas Weber interviews Sam Fine, a local politician and public servant. Tonko Tuesday this week was highlighted by Joe Ritchie, who spoke about his own experience growing up next to a hazardous waste incinerator.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly Tonko Tuesday update. I am your host, Lucas Weber. Today, Joe Ritchie from Cohoes spoke to the crowd about his experiences growing up under the shadow of Norlite, a hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes. With the Clean Future Act that Tonko is working on, there is currently a provision in the act that gives tax incentives to companies that burn trash. This is highly controversial because burning trash is not considered a renewable energy and regarded by many as not a viable method for creating a clean future. After Joe finished speaking, I found a local politician in the crowd and asked him a few questions. I'm currently talking with
Albany County Legislator Sam Fine.
And Sam, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a county legislator. I represent part of the South End and part of Arbor Hill within the city of Albany. And, you know, I'm just here to support the people of Cohoes who are subjected to poisonous air that they have to breathe every day from Norlite. And, you know, people throughout this country in the whole planet who are being impacted by climate change. So we need to take action.
Would you call yourself a politician?
I'd call myself a public servant, an elected official. You know, I'm in it because I believe in helping people and I want to make a difference.
How did you get into politics? From the beginning?
Well, I've always been interested in it. I was, you know, I think originally inspired by my grandfather. He worked his entire career pushing for a universal healthcare system. And just that, those values stuck with me and the idea that you can really make change through government and through policies, and the government can be a force for good. And that made me want to get involved in my community, wanted me to make a difference. And I believe that politics and in government is the way to do that.
So I'm just really interested to talk to you today because we all are here mostly about Paul Tonko, who is also a politician. And I would just love to get some of your input on what you think Paul Tonko is dealing with these days. I think a lot of us would say, if we had the choice, that if we were in his shoes, we would take out the trash incineration incentives from the Clean Future Act. But you, as a politician, like, what is going on in his head? Like, what are his different pressures and things that you would imagine he has to deal with in making this decision?
Well, yeah, I strongly urge Congressman Tonko to take out the incentives for waste-burning facilities out of the climate change bill. You know, I don't know his specific motivations. I know that, you know, he has often prided himself on being a leader on environmental issues. But, you know, we have to hold all elected officials accountable. I expect people to hold me accountable when I'm wrong. And, you know, on this issue, you know, I think he needs to take a stronger stand and ensure that he's protecting the health and environment of all of us.
If you were Paul Tonko right now, would you take out the trash incineration part of the Clean Future Act?
Yes, yeah, definitely. I don't think that incentives for trash incineration should be in that bill. I mean, we know from right here, from in Cohoes, it's poisoning people, it's killing people. And as Joe Ritchie mentioned earlier, most of these facilities are in low-income communities. And, you know, everyone deserves to breathe clean air. How much money you have, what your economic status is, what your background, that should have nothing to do with it. So I think it needs to come out. And if I were Paul Tonko, I would support taking that out.
So last week there was a Zoom meeting with Paul Tonko and a lot of local organizations about the Clean Future Act. And Tonko was saying that the bill is in progress and it needs to go through the traditional political, you know, going through the right people, and it'll take a while. Like, what? And a lot of organizations were a little upset about that because the climate is not something that is really, we don't have a lot of time, you know. So can you talk to me about like how climate change is different than other matters because of the time aspect in terms of being a politician?
Yeah, I mean, it is an extremely urgent issue. It's been ignored for far too long, and so we have very limited time. So I believe it's an issue that all of us, especially our elected leaders, have to take seriously and have to take urgent action on. We can't really be incremental at this point. We need, you know, fundamental change to our systems, to our whole society and how we operate.
So is Paul Tonko right in saying that, you know, it'll take some time, or should he be more urgent and more pressing on getting this Clean Future Act through and removing the trash incineration incentives from it?
Well, you know, I don't want to speak to exactly the barriers within Congress he's facing. I'm sure that there are a lot of pressures there. Obviously, we know it's not easy to get bills passed in Congress. We know that it's not easy to create real structural change. Although, you know, I believe that Paul Tonko should be leading the way to do so.
Joe was talking a little bit about Lights Out Norlite and Norlite as a place. Can you tell me a little about your involvement with Norlite and Lights Out Norlite?
Yeah, I've been working with Joe Ritchie and with Lights Out Norlite for a while now, and just, you know, supporting the initiatives they've been working on, calling out the DEC for their inaction on the issue. And it's just, you know, it's appalling that the leaders in Cohoes and the leaders in this county have allowed an operation like Norlite to go on for so long when it's clearly, you know, hazardous and poisoning the people around them. And it's just, you know, just another, you know, example of government failing working people and failing regular people. We have to stand up, and, you know, it's amazing what Lights Out Norlite is doing. They've created so much awareness and I think so much movement on this issue just in the last couple years. But, you know, there's still a lot more work to go.
How did you get involved with Joe and Lights Out Norlite?
Well, I was running last year I ran for assembly in a district that includes Cohoes. And, you know, it's just an issue. I heard a lot from residents, from Joe and other, you know, residents of Saratoga Sites, public housing next to Norlite, and other residents around there, you know, just about what they're facing on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, it was very clear to me, you know, from the start that, you know, it's an issue. And it reminded me instantly of a lot of issues I've been working on in right next to my county legislative district in the South End, where you have residents of Ezra Prentice Public Housing who are breathing toxic air because hundreds of diesel-powered trucks drive by every day. They're right next to the Port of Albany. You know, reminding me of the Answers plant just steps from where we are now that was poisoning people and gave people, a lot of people, cancer in Arbor Hill and throughout Albany in a low-income neighborhood because the state decided to power their plaza with a coal-burning plant right in a low-income neighborhood. And, you know, these are instances of this throughout the state. So, you know, it's something that I, you know, recognize as part of this larger struggle for environmental justice.
Thank you. How has learning about the people that are being affected day to day by these hazardous waste plants and, you know, you're saying the diesel trucks and things, how has meeting these people in person kind of changed your outlook on what is important to you?
Well, it's definitely when you talk to someone who's personally affected, you know, that I think personal story, you know, it really affects you more. You know, data and statistics are important, but when you hear from an actual person, it's more impactful. Actually, earlier I said it was my grandfather who really inspired me to get involved in politics. He once said something to me. He said, statistics are human beings with the tears wiped dry. So I think, you know, oftentimes we have to hear, you know, those personal from the people who are really impacted to fully moves us on the issue.
If you had anything else to say to the people listening on the radio about Tonko Tuesdays, Paul Tonko, being a politician yourself, your lens of being a politician, what would you say?
Just, you know, encourage everyone to stay informed about the issues, to get involved, to come to events like this, you know, and other events, and, you know, stand up for what you believe in and try to make change, because it's really going to take that. We're up against a lot of pressures. It's not easy to get things to change, so we all have to get involved and vote.
Yeah, so going off that, why is it important to be out here, you know, showing up to events like this?
I think just raising awareness of the issues and showing support, every little bit matters, you know, collectively. If we all come out and speak our mind about the issues that impact us, that's how we're going to achieve change. If we stay home and we're silent, then the leaders that we elect, they don't hear our points of views, and they don't hear why it's important to us that they take action on issues. So you know, it sometimes can seem like maybe you're just, you know, one person, and it seems like it can be an uphill battle, but it all collectively together, it all makes a difference.
Thank you, Sam. That's all my questions.
Yep. Thank you, Luke.
That was Sam Fine, Albany County Legislature of the 6th District. Sam Fine has been involved with Lights Out Norlite, the community group in Cohoes that is trying to shut down Norlite, a hazardous waste incinerator in the town. To learn more about Sam Fine, you can visit his webpage at fineforassembly.com. That's F-E-I-N forassembly.com. For more information on Lights Out Norlite, please visit lightsoutnorlite.org. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to tune in next Thursday for another in-depth look at Tonko Tuesdays.
That was Lucas Weber speaking with politician and public servant Sam Fine. Visit mediasanctuary.org to listen to past segments and tune in every week for ongoing coverage of the current Tonko Tuesday rally.
On July 17, 2021, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry went to a free community breakfast in downtown Troy, sponsored by Grace Fellowship church members.
Yo, this is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. And I'm down here, I think it's about 9:30, at Sunhe Farm and Kitchen, La Capitolo Taco, which is located at Ferry and Four.
Mm-hmm, the parking lot, yeah.
Right, and they're having a community breakfast here. And I have one of the person who responsible for this community breakfast, and it's a lot of people around. And your name is?
My name is Diane Film.
Diane Film, right. So how you doing, Diane?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
All right. So Diane, tell me something about this event. You know, who's sponsoring it, and who are you? And
all right, I'll try to be quick because it's a little bit of a long story. So about a month or so ago, I volunteer at Joseph's house, and I was unloading pancake mix. And there was a lot of pancake mix. And I said to one of the gentlemen that works there, I said, you guys should have a community pancake breakfast. And he said, that's a great idea. Well, you know, life happens. And our church, a couple weeks, challenged us they gave us, a few of us, $200. The church is Grace Fellowship Church, which is up in Latham, right over across, like, kind of Waterville area. It has a couple campuses, but that's the main one. And they challenged 50 people to step up and take $200 and bless someone that got affected by COVID. So my husband and I, we felt compelled to go up and do this. We had no idea who we were gonna bless or what to do with the money. And it went a little while, and I prayed about it, and nothing was coming to me. And our pastor started doing a sermon on flourishing, and it reminded me of that pancake mix. And God said to me, I felt like God was saying to me, that community breakfast, Diane, was for you to do. And So he, one morning I felt like he woke me up and Jesus just really laid out the whole program, how it was going to happen, what I'm going to do with this $200. We were going to have a community breakfast because I wanted, let me back up a second. I still couldn't figure out who to bless and who hasn't been affected by COVID, right? Like, how do you pick? And that's where I felt like he's like, you need to bless the community of Troy because I'm in part of the community. This is my neighbors. This is where I come. COVID has been really hard. It's really hit us hard, you know, from loneliness to job losses to death. You know, my uncle passed away.
Was it COVID?
It was COVID. Yeah. So there was a lot, you know, and that's just me. And there's other people that have more tragic things happen as well. So that morning, I felt like in my spirit that he laid out the whole thing. You're going to do a breakfast, but it's going to be completely donated. Everything that you see here today, this breakfast is completely donated by friends, neighbors, community, businesses, all from Troy. And so I was like, so what do I do with the money? And what we took with the money is we went into local businesses. The vision was to go to local businesses and purchase some gift cards to then give to people as well. So it's kind of a, you know, they'll come in and bless the businesses. So it's kind of like a double blessing.
I think people want to get out.
Yeah, get out and do something, find something new. So right away, my husband and I, we matched the $200. We had another couple that go to church with us, and they did the same thing, and people started to come alongside of us. We multiplied that $200 over tenfold so that we were able to go out to over 41 businesses in the local area. I wish it was more, but we had about 3 weeks to do it. And the response was amazing. Like, people in the businesses gave to us as well. The Capital Taco blessed us by, we're using their kitchen. It's just amazing. We just walked in and Yair, who's the owner, he was like, whatever you guys need, you can use. And the conversations, I've been into businesses I probably wouldn't walk into normally. And the response has just been amazing. You know, we're hungry for community. We're hungry for communication and binding together rather than what divides us, but what kind of unifies us.
And you live in this immediate neighborhood?
We live a little, like 5 minutes up the hill from Troy. So I'm in Troy a lot. I do a lot of business down here. So that's how this all started.
So you've been living here long?
My husband grew up in Troy, where we live up the hill. He grew up with his family, so he's been here all his life. I came from Delaware. I went to Russell Sage College. And went away for a little bit to work, and we're back. We've been here over 20 years.
Now, the church you go to, you say, is in Latham?
Latham.
Right, so you got them involved with it?
So they actually helped us out. So they gave us that seed money.
The seed money.
Yeah, just that little seed, and it's multiplied tenfold. And then they have helped us with, they're loaning us their tables. They printed the flyers for us. The youth group printed the signs for us. So a little bit, you know, that was community involvement with them as well.
Now, is this something that you have you ever done something like this before?
I have never done this ever. I have to tell you that when I had that idea, I was like, okay, God, I can't do this by myself. And he was like, I know. And right away, people came around me that had administrative, talents, right? Artistic talents. Like, it just fell into place. But you know what? You have to ask. You got to step forward, and you can't just sit and have everything think it's going to happen. Like, I had to step out in faith.
Now, so you've been living here, so what do you think of the neighborhood?
The neighborhood does change, yeah, but I think there's changes for good, changes that are hard on people too. So, you know, that's why I think as community we need to reach out even more so for the good things and the hard things.
This COVID been happening, your church, was your church going virtual or what?
Our church did go virtual. Yeah, we had to not gather together. I mean, I think that was ordered by our governor, right? Not to gather. So they did everything virtual. And actually, a few of us gathered in my backyard. We watched it on TV so we could still be outside and have our masks and be safe. But still have a tiny bit of community.
Right. Yeah. So how has it affected your family, per se? I mean, have you been able to see your go see family now?
So now I can, yeah. It's good to be together. We do live next to my husband's mom, so we could do some things cautiously, you know, to help her out. You know, she's in her 80s. I have two boys and they live out on their own. One just moved off of Fifth Street. One has been on Hoosick. He's in and out driving to Rochester. And yeah, so they're just trying to be cautious. We had a crazy Christmas because one did come down with COVID, so we had to be separated at Christmas. And the other one thought he was exposed. We did Christmas presents by FaceTime. Yeah, so that's been tricky.
Well, I've been listening to people here, you know, people passing down while I was sitting there eating my breakfast. And for the breakfast, what do you have for breakfast? Tell the audience.
So for breakfast, we have pancakes, sausage, syrup, coffee, juice, water. Kind of simple, but just, you know, it's first time just trying to throw that. Yeah.
And people have been coming by, you know, like I say, passing me saying, hey, this is a good thing. They really like it. You know, then over the one first of all, I heard that they were just walking in the neighborhood and they're saying it was
good.
The kids, and they said, oh, yeah, kid pulled them in here.
Yeah.
Probably because of the balloons, too.
Yes. Trying to, you know, sometimes you hear about stuff and sometimes you walk by, and that's just how you catch it, right? So
in the future now.
Yes.
You know, since you got this skill, you know, and this knowledge. So you think maybe some other time you might do other things maybe in the future.
I would love to do more things to reach out and promote more things in community. I don't know what that's going to be. I definitely have to pray about that. There's lots of opportunities in Troy to impact people, right? To help out.
Right. And it's a good thing. And Dan, I want to thank you for just sitting down with me at the spur of the moment to do this.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it was good, you know, getting this information. And I think people, you know, like to hear when people do things to help.
It's good to hear good things, right? We've heard enough bad things. Yes.
Right.
Good news doesn't always sell, but you know what? That's what gets our heart better, right? And heals us. There's a lot of healing with good things. You know, a cheerful heart brings good medicine.
Let's leave it at that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
You're very welcome.
We just heard Diane Film, organizer of the free community breakfast in downtown Troy. Thank you, Willie Terry, for checking out the event, which was put on in part by the Grace Fellowship Church members. Look out for more events from the 4th and Ferry Lot space between Sunhees Farm and Kitchen and Capital Tacos.
Retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson is back for another segment with HMM correspondent Dulciana Diggs for As the World Turns. In part one of her ongoing series, Mr. Johnson touched upon the differences between climate and weather, hurricane season, and much more.
Hello, this is HMM correspondent Dulciana Diggs. Today, I'm speaking with Hugh Johnson, the retired meteorologist. Last time we spoke, he had predicted an early summer, but I'm sure the question that's on everyone's mind is, what's up with all this rain? Please welcome my guest, Mr. Johnson. How are you doing today?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm well. Thank you for asking. Okay, so let's get started. What is the difference between weather and climate?
Very good question. I mean, we've talked about it before, but it's always good to review. Basically, weather is when you talk about the atmosphere changes over a quick interval of time, like day to day, hour to hour, temperature, dew point, wind, barometer, whether it's raining or not, that's weather. But when you take a long-term index, what the average weather does over a fixed amount of time, whether it be 10 or 30 years, that's more climate. And it's interesting you brought this subject up because the NCTC, which is the folks that take care of keeping an eye on the climate, they have updated the climate, the average 30-year average. The new one came out from 1990 to 2020, came out not that long ago. And what's interesting is it's all showing that warming is continuing. If you look at our average, you look at other cities, they've gone up a degree or two. The average temperature high, the average low over a 30-year period. For instance, the city I lived in, Philadelphia, now has a temperature of normal high of 88 this time of year. It used to be 86. So that's essentially what Washington, D.C. was 30 years ago. Washington, D.C., on the other hand, had 88. Now they're at 90. So their average temperature is close to the ones in the Carolinas. So what you're seeing is the average high is showing that the average summer temperature is going up, gradually upticking with time. And that's, you know, probably going to keep on going. But climate is a long-term indice of what the weather does.
Okay, thank you so much for that review, Mr. Johnson. So what about the heat wave in the Northwest where Portland hit 116 degrees? Was that just an aberration, or can we blame that on climate change?
That's another good question. There has been a lot of debate over people in the meteorological field over that. You know, generally speaking, one event you cannot say is due to climate change, but let's do something in perspective. So that was back in late June, Portland. Let's talk about that. On Saturday, I believe it was June 26 or whatever, Portland, Oregon hit 108 degrees, which was not only shattered the record by, like, I think over 10 degrees for that day. It was already the highest temperature they ever had. Their old record high was 107. Then came Sunday. On Sunday, the temperature soared to 112. So you took an all-time record, never been done before, and you've added 4 more degrees on it the next day. Not done yet. On Monday, we added 4 more degrees to the 112, making it 116. Now, so in other words, it was 8 to 9 degrees hotter than they ever had seen before. And keep in mind, in Portland, Oregon, the average high temperature at that point was 78. Now it might be 80-ish. But, you know, basically what we have, actually maybe even a point or two cooler. So, you know, you say, okay, one event. Then earlier in the month, Tucson almost hit their all-time record in mid-June, 114 versus 117, I think is their all-time record. So, you know, you start seeing this kind of thing, and in my personal opinion, you know, it's complicated, but there's no question that indirectly this is a result of climate change. We just see more and more intense heat waves, some cold waves like the one we had in Texas back in February, and all kinds of weird stuff going on all over the world. So, you know, I think it certainly is an indirect result of climate change, and I think we're going to, and also with all that heat, it has cooled off a little bit, still above normal. They actually damaged a lot of evergreens out there. There were pictures that they showed of evergreens that literally died because it was so hot, and now there's a tinderbox out there. Now they got wildfires. We've been seeing more and more wildfires over the last several years in California and the Northwest, so I mean, this is definitely part of climate change, and it is definitely showing, you know, it's like a red flag. It's showing that things are not doing well.
And how worried should we be as a society?
Well, we should be definitely concerned. I mean, I'm not worried. I don't want to get people panicking. And, you know, again, everyone has a different opinion, but there has been a lot of experts are saying that we have 7 years to get it right, to get climate, to try to reverse it. The fossil fuel argument, things like that. We're still adding lots of fossil fuel into the atmosphere. We're trying to, you know, cut the rate down, but we're still adding it. We're well over 40 million parts per million. We cracked through that a couple of years ago. But, you know, it's definitely something that even if, like, my generation gets through without having reach a true crisis, the younger generation, millennials and Zers, are definitely going to be in trouble if we don't do something soon. I don't have a number, but, you know, I mean, I don't want to say 7 years is a number, but we got to focus on doing something pretty soon. Some people are saying 2050 to have zero carbon emissions, but a lot of other people saying it should be closer to 2030. And again, it becomes a political strife, definitely concerned. And we just gotta hope we keep voting the right people in, and we work towards the right policy. I don't know if it's gonna happen, but that's what I'm thinking. It's definitely a concern.
Okay, and for crying out loud, I know everyone is wondering what is going on with our summer. One minute it's hot, next minute it's raining, and honestly, this rain is getting to be draining. Could you touch upon what's going on with that?
Okay, sure. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so What's been happening this summer is there's been a ridge out west. It's kind of been oozing around. It really sunk over the northwest, bringing that record heat wave in late June, and it kind of then weakened and moved south, but it's still basically out west. And there's another ridge to our east, part of the Bermuda High, but we're sandwiched in between what's called a trough. So the jet stream gets pushed up by the ridge, and then it sinks down a little bit. And on paper, it doesn't look all that strong, but what's happening is it's kind of in place, and we've been kind of getting on the side of the trough where we're getting moisture pushed up along from the Gulf and from the Atlantic, and we've been kind of like, not that the air is that cool, but it's cool enough that we're getting what's called overrunning precipitation. We've had like these fronts that have stalled just to our south, and we've had waves of low pressure moving along it, and that's basically been the demise of this July. It started on July 1st. You remember it was hot in late June, and then all of a sudden it cooled. Like you said, it cooled off and got rainy. And we've been stuck in this pattern since. There is some hope in the future that it kind of weakens, but it doesn't go totally away. One of the other problems was we had this an anomalous high over in the northeast that kind of blew on in this added flow of moisture off the ocean, and that's why we got that soaking rain a couple days ago. And that's weakened, thankfully, and gone a little further east. But we're still in this trough, and hopefully what might be happening is we might start seeing a more northwesterly flow. The trough moves a little further to the east as well. We might cut off that moisture supply. But yeah, it's been terrible. I mean, we've been stuck in between ridges of high pressure, and we've been getting we're averaging, 5 degrees below normal in July, but again, we're still stuck with that cool thermometer. That hasn't changed. We talked about that a few months ago in our last interview, and they're still using the thermometer that now they know it's 2 degrees too low, if not a little more, and they're still using it. I cannot believe it. In June, my average temperature was 71.9, the average low and high combined for the whole month. The airport was 3 degrees cooler than that, so they look like they end up being slightly cooler than normal. But actually, June, if you take most people, was a little bit above normal. This month has been below normal, because we've had so many clouds and so much rain, and so we have been running a little bit below normal. So unfortunately, we're stuck in the bad side of the trough, and hopefully that will change in the next week or two.
Wow, Mr. Johnson, what another informative interview on climate change. Please, do you have any final words?
Yeah, stay cool. Anticipate the possibility of flooding this summer. I'm afraid to say it, but I think this could be in the cards for us if this weather pattern holds. It's starting to really concern me that we're going to have some problem flooding. I hope I'm wrong. But it's just something that the pattern we're in and the active hurricane season and the fact that a lot of them are coming up the East Coast could spell trouble. So just anticipate that the best you can. And, always try to, if you can avoid using your car and walk somewhere at least once a week, try to do that if you can.
Okay, folks. Well, that was Mr. Johnson, retired meteorologist. And this has been HM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for WOC 105.3 FM.
Dulcinea Diggs brings us part one of her ongoing series with retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson. Stay tuned to Hudson Mohawk Magazine for more trending weather conversation and information. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lizzie Kramer.
And I'm Jody Cowan. Our engineer is Sina Bazila Hickey. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by the independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and economic and social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.